Hey everyone, I am Mel and I am a grateful alcoholic. And by the grace of God, and only because of the Worldwide Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to take a drink since December 1st of 1986, for which I am incredibly grateful. Our home group is the Dawsonville Gratitude Group. We're about an hour and a half north of here in the mountains, and we actually meet every day at different times if you want to come up. Saturday morning's a favorite of mine. Another doctor. I'm not used to talking from the podium as a doctor, and it was a doctor in AA. Her name's Dr. Penny, at least that's what my kids call her. Hi, Susan, who talked about how, and I'm not going to get what tradition or whatever it is, but that basically the idea if you know I'm a doctor and we're sitting in the rooms together, that's going to interfere with our relationship. There's like a tradition on that one. I can't think of it right now, but what I do for work does not matter, you know, which is of course why it's always, you know, particularly touching when one of us is in the hospital and, you know, you go up to the information desk and you're like, hey, what room is Mary in? And they're like, Mary who? Like, Mary the gardener, you know. I actually heard a story recently, and I suspect it's true, that when someone went up to the information booth at the hospital and said Mary the gardener or kind of whatever it was, they knew where Mary the gardener was, you know. And she's in 432. I say that I'm a grateful alcoholic because a lady named Helen O, soon after we moved to Williamsburg, Virginia, said something that I had never heard, and I'd been coming to these rooms for a few 24 hours, and she said that she had been told that a grateful alcoholic would not drink. Hello. And I was like, whoa, you know, how could I have not heard that? Now, gratitude list, attitude of gratitude. Not that I hadn't heard of gratitude, but like a guarantee like that, a grateful alcoholic won't drink. I thought I'd better take that under advisement. And in fact, I just realized the license plate on our car still says grateful, doesn't it? Yeah. So that's why I say I'm a grateful alcoholic. And I told my whole story this morning as soon as I got up, so I have no idea what I'm actually going to say right now. But I was struck by what was coming up. So kind of we'll see what comes out. If any of you have not seen the sober comedian Mark Lundholm and you would like to laugh your rear end off, he is still available to watch. And one of the things he was saying last night was that he's multilingual. And I'm multilingual, too. I can speak AA, I can speak Al-Anon, I can speak Overeaters Anonymous, and on occasion I can even speak Narcotics Anonymous, all of which is cool. You know, and the place that a power greater than myself took me in a serious way, not that I hadn't visited there before, under the don't make me have to go to Al-Anon category of your behavior. But the place that a power greater than myself took me one time when every one of you was not enough was actually Al-Anon. And that I got even more relief and more spiritual incredibleness from there. So there's no doubt whatsoever that I'm alcoholic. I thought of that thing, you know, I've drank more alcohol than you've spilled on your tie thing, but it's probably not true in this room. But I do have a little, and I figure you guys want to hear doctor part. So, I mean, I'm going to get to that. But just so that you know I belong here, there may be some of you who are familiar with that there's a special time of the year for alcoholics. I'm not quite sure when it is, but it has to do with that the light at sort of the time that you would get up and get dressed to go to work in the morning is about the same hour at the end of the day also. And so, for instance, you know, I was at a point with my drinking that I couldn't stand up in the shower. You know, I couldn't close my eyes in the shower or I would fall over. And I was in the Navy at that point, so I would have to wash my hair in the kitchen sink so I could close my eyes, then go to the shower to take the rest of my shower, you know, then put on my uniform. So this one particular day, I'd, you know, been at work and came home from work and went to bed. And there was drinking, of course, before, you know, as soon as I got home. But and I woke up. And it was, you know, whatever, 7 o'clock and time to get ready to go to work. So I got out of bed and went to the kitchen sink and washed my hair and went to the shower and washed myself and put on my uniform and got in my car and drove to downtown Cleveland, Ohio. I worked at the Navy Finance Center in the Federal Building there up on the 26th floor. Now, this was in the early 80s, so it's a different way than it is now. You know, people actually know about federal buildings and their stuff. But and Cleveland isn't a city like, I don't know how Atlanta is, but it's one of those cities where in the morning, there's a million billion cars on the road, everyone's going to work. But in the evening, no one's going in there. But I didn't notice that. So I got in the car, drove downtown, got an excellent parking spot, went up to the 26th floor before I realized that the place wasn't open. And somehow realized that it was the same night I'd already been to work that day. Fortunately, I knew I shouldn't get in the car and drive home again. And I'd already set off the alarm and, you know, I did the good alcoholic thing and made up a story and that made sense to people. I have no idea why, about why I should go in and lay down and, you know, be there the next morning when everyone else came in. So, so for sure, I'm that girl. But the thing I thought about this morning, for whatever reason, was I was somewhere recently. We were talking about, could you tell when it happened? Actually, I was giving a talk to people new with addiction and asking, can some of you tell when it happened? Plenty of us, we can't. But I was sort of probably brewing to be alcoholic when I was in college. But one day came where a friend of mine said, hey, my boyfriend, who was just visiting, left his pot. You want to try that? And I was like, okay, let's do that. And so we smoked the pot, and we looked out the window of her room, which looked down onto the pool. I was at a small women's college, and my roommate was down there on a towel. And my roommate was a very not interesting person in any way. And I looked out, and I was like, it's Becky. And a voice came into my brain that said, you need to feel like this all of the time. That's what it said. And, you know, within a couple of years, I had progressed to, in my senior year of college, you know, what it took just for me to kind of relax and sit down and try and read a pleasure book was Pink Floyd, The Wall album on headphones, bong hits, and I had this amazing technique that had just sort of naturally developed where I could take a pint of ice cream and a box of Hostess chocolate-covered donuts, and somehow I knew just exactly how to one spoonful of ice cream onto each bite of those donuts until the whole thing was over. I never ran out of ice cream, never had too much ice cream or too much donut, kind of the whole thing. And that was just what it took for me to sit down and read a book, you know, just to sit down and read a book. And I had this bong that was very special to me. It was the USS Enterprise, and it looked like the USS Enterprise. And, you know, part of my story is that I went from being the girl as a freshman who had written next week's 101 English paper the week before to the girl who, you know, waited till the very last day to fill out the application and get it in the mail to medical school, you know, and that sort of stuff. But there was some sort of a miracle going on, and I was going to medical school, but I realized that it was probably going to be too difficult and I couldn't smoke pot anymore. But I couldn't not take the Enterprise with me because it was very special, and I thought, like, you remember those air plants? Some of you might remember we had those air plants. I thought maybe I could use it, kind of put some air plants in it or something like that. And I went off to medical school and found out somehow that I could still keep smoking pot. What time do I have to stop?
Just keep going. You got to stop at 55.
Okay. So So what ended up happening was, you know, the day came when smoking pot was not enough, you know, and I had, not that I hadn't been drinking and doing, you know, all sorts of things that do and don't make for good telling from the podium, but there came a point where marijuana absolutely didn't do it anymore, and pouring alcohol in a serious way is definitely what was required. And I had always had this thing that some of you might have it of not being enough, being less than, not fitting in medical school, that turned into a, and you're incompetent and they don't, and they're going to find you out. Now I have heard, I was going to say housewives. Do we use that term anymore? Anyway, you know, but I'm going to say it, okay? I've heard housewives from the podium talk about being a fraud and they're going to find you out. So for me, I think this was my alcoholism, but I didn't know it at the time. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair were definitely breathing down my neck in medical school, which really just meant I needed to pour more alcohol in to kind of quiet that down. But it also meant I couldn't show up to work. It was work for me because I thank you very much. You all paid, that are old enough, paid for my medical school. I was on a Navy scholarship. And so being in medical school was actually work for me too. But still not showing up because I had to stay home and drink. And because I was terrified that you were going to find out that I was a fraud and incompetent. You know, that got to the point that there was one rotation where we were coming to the end. It was pediatrics. And the guy calls me and he's like, you have not been here for half of the days you were supposed to be here. You know, do you have an explanation for that? And I didn't have a good one, but whatever. It sort of said nothing. He said, well, we'll see what happens but at the test at the end of the thing, you know, whatever. And, you know, another one, psychiatry, where, you know, and I started doing this, I guess it's called lying. Okay, I was going to say making up stories. So it's called lying about why I wasn't coming into work, you know. I mean, and this is so alcohol, you know, I would, I actually had makeup, you know, so at one point it was, you know, that I was, I was having terribly heavy periods and I was probably anemic and, you know, a little black under the eyes and white on the rest of the face, you know. I actually, thank goodness I had, you know, I mean, amends, thank goodness we have that opportunity and that we can do that in person, and God puts amazing situations sometimes on that. For my family medicine rotation, I hadn't gone at all, I think, and I needed to do something about that. So I called one of the female docs in the practice and said, would you meet me at a restaurant near where we were? And I told her that my roommate had raped me, and that's why I hadn't come into work. And again, thank goodness it was a different time because, you know, in this day and age, what would have happened to that guy? You know? Boy, it was a different time back in the 80s. So eventually, you know, then there was the emergency room rotation and, oh my gosh, you know, and it was like, I kept, you know, that I'll quit tomorrow thing. It was, I'll go tomorrow, you know. Well, I can go on the weekend, you know, there are enough weekends left. I never went. I just never went. I actually read my, review for that one time, and I did quite well, and I actually understood why that happened, and it was because the resident who had to do the, you know, had like a pile of medical school, you know, things to fill out for a whole bunch of people, and his roommate was in my class, and so he'd just be like, Mel Warner, what's, oh yeah, she's good, okay, and so he just filled them all out, and never even went. So, this did not help my feeling of being a fraud and incompetent, as you might imagine. And now I'm graduating from medical school, you know, where I can't just go crawl under a rock somewhere and into a bottle. I'm on active duty in the Navy and they expect me to show up and work. And so I got to a point where I could not stand it anymore. I was convinced that someone was going to be gravely injured or worse because of me and my incompetence. I was going to say a weird thing happened, but there are no coincidences anymore. We actually got an extra intern came on to our service, which that never happens. And I was like, all right, I'm out. You know, I cannot. Oh, so the thing I haven't mentioned is that I knew that something was terribly wrong. You know, I knew something was terribly wrong, and I knew what it was. You know, it was that I was a doctor, and I shouldn't be a doctor. I'm not kidding you. Okay, and we have studied this, actually. In case you don't know, 95% of people with addiction don't actually know that that's what they have. Until someone tells them that, then it's a different story. But, you know, so this girl's drinking, you know, half a fifth a day, and no idea I'm alcoholic. Although, when finally someone told me, I went, yeah, I guess I can see that. But so I could not work as a doctor, but I was in the Navy. So what am I going to do? So back then, we used to do everything when we were interns. So in other words, we drew the blood, we started the IVs, kind of all this sort of stuff. And that you had to do all that just to know what was going on. So I was like, keen alcoholic thinking. Okay, so if I can't use my hands, can't draw blood, can't start IVs, you know, can't take care of patients. This is good. So, but as a physician, I knew that hands are very complicated. There are all kinds of bones and tendons. You know, you mess them up, you can be really messed up. However, it turns out that the arm, very simple, just two bones. Okay? So I'm like, that's it. If I break both of my arms, totally will not be able to take care of patients. They'll find something else for me to do, which they actually did later when marijuana took me out of the Navy. I became a secretary at the Finance Center in the Federal Building, but anyway, that's a different thing. So I had to run my arm. Well, so I decided I would run my arms over with the car. That's how I would break my arms and not be able to go to work. And now, so this thing had happened. You know, we didn't have the internet and such back then. We had 800 numbers and catalogs that came to your house. And so I would get presents all of the time in the mail because in blackouts, I would order stuff. So I knew that there was, you know, that there was like a certain amount that I, you know, in other words, so I had figured out that there's a fifth, right? We didn't even have liters back then. So if I only drank half the bottle, okay, so half of a fifth, then I wouldn't necessarily go into a problematic blackout and, you know, would still be able to get up and go to work in the morning. So I figured I needed some anesthesia before I broke my arms and that, but that I had to be careful not to drink too much, you know, and I'd put everything away at work and sort of this was my plan. And, but I knew it. So I wake up at 9:30 the next morning and I'm like, argh. I didn't run my arms over with the car. And I'm AWOL, of course, which, so, you know, got up, you know, went down, put the car on the top of the hill of the parking lot, you know, got it rolling, ran around behind it, put my arms underneath, car goes rolling over my arms, then starts to bounce down the driveway out into the street. This was in Norfolk, Virginia. And I'm like, oh no, it's going to hit cars. What's going on? And I have to get up and deal with this thing. And nothing happened here, so I had to put together a new plan. And that plan ultimately started with a gift of being able to get introduced to this amazing program. You know, and I'm pretty sure my time's up, so I guess that means this is what I was going to talk about. Thank you, sir. And you know, I had to get some outside help recently, which required, and this is not the first time in sobriety I've had to do that, but which required, you know, going under the knife, under anesthesia, and then, in this case, taking 2 days of scary pain medicine. And, you know, where I went is where I go after a thing happens like that. And you can ask my family, you know. They put me in the car, or if I had to get someone else to do that, and, you know, I was done by noon. So at 12 o'clock, I was at the gratitude group of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, don't ask me what condition. You'd have to ask them what kind of condition I was in. But, you know, I showed up there. I showed up there every day. It turns out I got signed up to chair the meeting on Saturday after, you know, no coincidences, right? And I got to tell you, by Saturday, and I'll close with this, I was a fest, and I was going to the meetings every day, and I was a festering boil of self-centered expectation and no acceptance, and it didn't matter. You know, I hobbled my little self in and sat down and followed the format, you know, and didn't drink that day and didn't do any of the other things I'm prone to do, and, you know, and stayed sober, you know. And the gift of all of that, besides the fact that, you know, hopefully I can start running again eventually and that my knee's going to be cool, is that because I'm new to Dahlonega. I've only been going there for a few months, and now they know me better. They got me really vulnerable. You know, they were there for me. I will always remember, because I have this in Williamsburg with Michael, who was there after a shoulder surgery of mine. He had just come to the area. You know, I'll remember Robert, because Robert held the door open for me, you know, while I was on crutches and said, "Do you need a ride somewhere?" You know, because that's what we do. You know, that's what we do. And, you know, this thing wants me back. You know, I am the pour the whiskey in the milk girl. I have known it for a long time, and I don't doubt it for a moment, you know. So to be here, and I guess to be of service and to be with you, I could not be happier. And I thank you so much for my sobriety.
Thanks, Mel. So is anybody here not a physician? I know there's a lot. So let me wonder about how many of you are getting a little nervous about your healthcare provider, of which 3 or 4, maybe 5% should be in his room. So I'd be taking a little note, such as the smell and whatever. Thank you. That was wonderful. Our next guest lecturer is Lisa L. You're up.
Good morning. My name is Lisa L., and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic and addict. Lisa. And thank you all so much for getting up on this morning of freedom. AA means freedom to me, freedom from drugs and alcohol, and that's why I'm here, because my life was just sad before I found AA. I come from a long line of drinkers. My entire family is either alcoholic or addict. They don't know this. when I first was able to have my learner's permit, my job was to go to the liquor store and pick up alcohol for my parents. My brothers, just a year and a half and 3 years older than me, were already deep into drug and alcohol in their teenage years. And I thought I was the saved child, because I was looking at all of them and going, why are they trying to escape from life? What is wrong with them? I understood that my parents were drinking more than they were supposed to. I didn't have quite the words alcoholism yet. But the guy next door, who was about 20 years older than my father and was one of his big drinking buddies, used to say, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Because I get up in the morning and drink vodka first thing. And I'm like, okay, he's an alcoholic. I get that. That doesn't seem right. And the whole time I thought, I'm going to be the saved child. I'm not going to be the alcoholic. I saw what they were, and I didn't want to be it. And at the risk of offending every single member in this room, I didn't want to be in church basements with you. I really didn't. And my brothers were, you know, sort of the sad examples in my life. They were starting to lick things. This is the 70s, lick things off of pieces of foil, and anything that came their way, they did. And I just, you know, and they'd offer me these things, and I had no interest. Lots of times during my parents' parties, there would be adults that would think I needed a sip of their drink. And once or twice I did that, I drank like bourbon, and I'm like, God, this is vile. Why do you do this? So I thought I was the saved child. You know, then I go through my high school years. I developed a little early. I was the girl pushed ahead to go buy beer and wine and stuff at the stores. And I'm drinking with my friends, but I don't like the taste of alcohol. And it never occurred to me I like what alcohol is making me feel like. You know, all of a sudden I was starting to realize I felt like the comfortable girl in the social crowd, and I was never like that. I felt like I got taller, I got prettier, I got thinner, I got funny. You know, all of a sudden my inhibitions were gone, so I called it not drinking, I called it liquid confidence, because that's what it did for me in my life. And from there, I went on to college and on to medical school because in my family, we had a very sort of rigorous structure, and there was an awful lot of rules involved. We had to, you know, live our life by the seven P's. You know, prior planning promotes perfection and prevents piss poor performance. That's the way we lived. That was the expectations of me. You know, so I needed to be the star child. I went to medical school. You know, and even in medical school, I didn't learn how to drink coffee. I just thought, I'm never going to be one of you guys. But somehow, it wasn't till I was in my residency that I started to get exposed to narcotics for stress-related illnesses, such as kidney stones and migraine headaches. I loved the feeling of Demerol. And I went on to become an anesthesiologist, even though my anesthesia chairman told me, you know what, you are at high risk. You know, I was honest to him with everything that I knew at that time, and he goes, you're at very high risk. You know, you might want to consider being in another profession. I'm like, no, no, I want keys to the city. You know, so I wound up going into anesthesia, and I wound up continuing to have medical issues, some with orthopedic issues, and I got exposed to more narcotics. And the last hospital admission I had for a terrible ankle injury, I came out on 11 medications, four of them were narcotics. And when I went back to work 4 months later for my disability, I decided to switch the medications to the ones I thought were better, which included Demerol. So it's like I turned right there, you know, and it wasn't, I still looked at all you and I'm like, I'm not part of this club. I'm not going to church basements. You guys are just weird. You know, what you represented was my family to me, and I thought I was everything but my family. And here I am, the same child, the saved child, you know, who has the same disease. It wasn't until I went to recovery, which was highly suggested to me if I wanted to keep my medical license, that I attend a rehab. So I was supposed to get myself evaluated first and pick a place to get evaluated that had a forensic psychiatrist. And if you all don't know what that means, that basically means a shrink who can go to court. You know, so I got really nervous about, like, I'm found out, I'm caught, what's going to happen to me? I started looking up the forensics for psychiatry, and it's like, well, they do special tests. They may take your hair to see how long you've been doing drugs. So one of the first things I did before I got evaluated by him is I went and had my hair cut. I had about an inch and a half left of hair. He couldn't tell how long I'd been doing drugs. You know, and it's... The crazy things, it didn't seem crazy at the time. And honestly, yet I can look at this behavior in the rearview mirror. I thought I was doing better on the drugs that I gave myself than on the drugs that were prescribed for me. I truly, in my heart, believed this. I had, as Mel explained to us, absolutely no concept of myself as a physician with a disease. And so from there, they suggested that I try, you know, at least a 30-day rehab. And I went to one. I found one that I thought seemed like a softer, kinder, gentler way. And I spent my 30 days there, met my best friend, who's one of my posse here in the front row. And what I learned there was that I'm a sick physician and that I need help. And what I started to learn there, which just continued to develop through my recovery, is alcohol was my first drug. And I never knew that until I started to allow the honesty of recovery to come in. You know, Demerol may have been my last drug, but I needed to be comfortable in my skin. And even though I couldn't stand the taste of almost, you know, any drink I tried till I started making gin fizzes and Mai Tais, and you know, if I could put the alcohol in something that tasted fruity, I could get it down, and then I got the effect. I got through my first 30 days, and as I was getting ready to be discharged, one of the last week things that they had me do was describe what I thought rehab was really about. And I took that opportunity to explain to them that I thought it was a very cleverly designed cult with a medical theme. And and could describe for every reason why we stand around and we chant and we're given special food and we're isolated, and but it's all for a good thing. And was a little surprised after those 30 days, they suggested I have, at least 60 or 90 more days in rehab. But the problem was, is they didn't have any healthcare providers any longer in this rehab. So I was allowed by my PCP to find another rehab, and I'd already had two or three that I'd looked at beforehand. So I actually wound up in the care of that lady, and I was in Williamsburg. And what I can tell you is when I landed there, I knew I needed the help. When I left there, I knew I could live. I thought, gosh, I'm an addict. At the time, I was just starting to learn I was also an alcoholic, and I thought, I'm a loser. Life as I know it is over. There's never going to be any more fun in life. There's never going to be any more meaning in life. I'm never going to feel comfortable with people. So I was literally sitting there thinking, death is an option. I didn't want to kill myself. I just didn't want to live. You know, so I was thinking in my head, I'm nowhere near as clever as Mel is. I wanted to die, but somebody had to be responsible for killing me because, you know, I'm a victim too. So I couldn't just do this myself. But I knew, what I really knew in my heart is I didn't want to live as an alcoholic and addict because I thought life was over. And then my best friend came to visit me, and we went out. It was actually on the July 4th weekend, so this must be our anniversary of me getting it. We went to the Williamsburg Inn and had brunch, because when you have guests there, you're actually allowed to have the responsibility of leaving campus and being able to do things in the regular community. One of the beauty of the things there, too, is that I was allowed to recover in the community, so I had a sponsor who was local there. And I went to brunch, and when the two of us entered, it's an L-shaped room, there was cackling and laughter and chairs falling over. And I'm sitting there, you know, it's still standing there, not sitting yet. I'm thinking, oh man, they're already having mimosas and I'm not allowed to have them and life is over and I'm never going to be happy again. Until we got seated and we turned the corner and I saw it was the director of the facility I was in with the head nurse, with the head art therapist, and several of the women from the community. That was my moment. That was my moment of grace. That's when I knew I could live in sobriety because I could have fun if they could. And that's the blessing of this. None of us have to live in this misery of disease. There is recovery. There is sobriety. There is fun in life. And if you guys didn't have fun last night, come on out tonight because it's going to be fun as well. They're putting on a kick-ass meeting here, aren't they? So I found sobriety. I found recovery. I found the will to live in a small little town in Virginia. And from there, I have, you know, gone back to my home, back to my haven't gone back to my job. I've had an awful lot of difficulty. I lost my license for a year. And then when I got my license back, I went to several interviews for anesthesia, and I found several groups who actually wanted me to be a member because I was a sober person at that point. I was a woman of courage, dignity, and honor, and you know, somebody who certainly was going to be monitored, so I wasn't going to be a problem in their facility. The problems that I came up with was that there are an awful lot of committees in the hospital that can now say, you know, we don't want to give you privileges to practice in this hospital because you're an addicted doctor. You know, and that's the cross that I bear. I have certainly done things that have lost my trust to the patient population I was taking care of. And that's a consequence of my disease. You know, I'm still willing to work with these hands, to work with these hands in recovery, to work with these hands as a physician. I'm headed now towards seeing whether or not I can get myself in Doctors Without Borders, because I've got hands that can still help out there. And if that's meant to be, it's meant to be, you know, and I'll know because God always opens a window. Right now I'm training a dog to be a therapy dog. She's going to be helping dyslexic children read. And that's good enough right now. And I thank you all for coming out here and helping me with my sobriety day and coming so early. Thanks.
Thanks, Lisa. Excellent. You know, when I listen to these stories, I'm supposed to listen to the stories. Well, my brain doesn't do that. It goes on to my own story. But but that's life, you know. And I was thinking, I mentioned the candy store, and I really do need to make amends to Nancy Knoll Labs, who brought in the Vicodin 25 years ago and helped me get really in love with that drug. They used to come in free samples. Can you believe that? Free. And you could get as many as you wanted, and you could even write a few prescriptions for yourself if you chose, but it came in little foil packages of two. And I used to store them in our basement in these ceilings. I could reach it. I could just have them all over. We moved, and I think some of them are still there. Darn. The next speaker is going to be Lynn. And Lynn at one time held my testicles in his hand. And that's figuratively not, that's not actually, sit down. You know, Lynn actually was the director of the Washington Physician Health Program, who helped me get along the path of where I'm at today. He is a urologist, long retired, did a lot of other things since then. But I do think of him in a fond testicular way. Because he really saved my life along with a few other folks in this room. It's nice to see people come in here. I see the posse up here and I know there's at least two people from Spokane in this room, my bride, and there's another one over there. Yeah. So, and he heard about this meeting here at our Wednesday meeting in Spokane. I want to introduce Lynn H. currently from Florida.
Thank you, Mike. Looking out over this room, I see a lot of support, and God knows I need it this morning. I see some old friends from Seattle and some IDA pals and some buddies from physician health programs. And unfortunately, there are seven members of my home group sitting right there in the center from the porch in Jupiter, Florida, several of whom have already admonished me not to embarrass them. You know, today is July 4th. That's Freedom Day. And I'm still working on freedom from bondage of self. Now, if I were back in my Seattle group at the end of the meeting when they asked for a burning desire or closing commentary, some wise guy would get up on this day and give you his Independence Day admonition. And Mel mentioned the 5th, and the admonition is, if you drink a 5th on the 4th, you will not go forth on the 5th. And a lot of my home group would moan after I said that. Anyway, I'm really excited to be here. And I used to start off my story by saying that I grew up in Aurora, Illinois. That's the vacation spot of the Midwest. Until I heard about this young kid who went to see his dad one day, and he said, "Dad, when I grow up, I want to be an alcoholic." And his dad looked at him and said, "Well, son, you got to make up your mind. You can't do both." And anyway, I went to Catholic parochial grade school and then went on to high school, military high school, where I was the lieutenant colonel, the cadet lieutenant colonel. I'm going to tell you some things that sound grandiose. I was asked to talk at IDA in San Diego years ago, and you got to title your talk for the program. So mine was called Falling Uphill, and the cadet lieutenant colonel is just an example of that. And then I went on to a college, a place called Notre Dame, small school in northern Indiana, used to play football. And that's where my drinking took off, and I thought that was appropriate because I learned later on that alcoholism was a disease of Irish Catholics. It gets fixed in Protestant basements. And anyway, I switched majors and had to spend an extra year at school there because of the draft. And so I had a full semester of doing nothing. So I took, you know, basket weaving 101 courses just, you know, to beat the draft. And I decided with my grandiosity to take quantitative analysis, you know, the most difficult chemistry course. Damned if I didn't flunk it, okay, because of my drinking, all right. And they yanked my medical school application. And I had to spend an additional year in grad school. But then I finally went on to Georgetown and continued to fall uphill. Who was the class president? Okay. And second year I was there, the chief of microbiology called me in and said, you know, you're flunking this course. And, of course, I attributed that to my vast presidential duties. Okay. But it wasn't. It was drinking. You start to see a pattern develop here. And so... anyway, I got my act together, and I did graduate, and so forth, and then went on to intern year, and that was great. Thank God that put a damper on my drinking, because, you know, it was 36 on, 12 off, that kind of thing. But however, on July 1st, my last rotation, emergency room, at 7 a.m., I was off, and where did I go? Straight to the nearest bar. I have a few beers to celebrate. Then eventually everybody got drafted, and I wound up in the Navy also, but I spent all my time with the Marine Corps, and I was a flight surgeon, so off to Chulai in Vietnam. And who was appointed the senior medical officer? Okay. And it was great. It was terrific. And I took care of my pilots. And the base commander called me in one morning, and he says, Doc, he says, well, I want to talk to you about something. I said, yes, sir, what's that, Colonel? He said, I want to talk to you about your drinking. I said, pardon me? He said, well, I noticed that you're down at the O Club every night drinking with those pilots. And, you know, you're 10 years older than most of them, and you're drinking them all under the table. And I said, oh, Colonel, sir, let me see if I can explain that to you. I'll have to do it in layman's terms, sir, so you can understand it. I said, well, what you don't understand, sir, is probably, you know, I eat before we go into the drink. Yes, he says, I didn't notice that. You always go through the food line. And I said, well, the other thing is a lot of the guys down there are drinking these carbonated beverages, you know, because mostly quinine water, tonic, to ward off malaria and everything. I said, I don't do that, sir, because when you drink carbonated beverages, the gas expands your stomach, there's faster gastric emptying time, the alcohol gets into your small intestine faster, it gets absorbed quicker, and you get drunk quicker, and I don't do that. And so he said, is that right? And I said, yes, sir. And let me explain also, you probably don't notice that I get up when we go out to the patio, and I do some deep breathing exercises out there, and I walk around, don't sit at the bar stool all night, and I'm going blah, 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 blah. And you know what? He believed me. You know what? I believe me. I thought my vast medical knowledge about the metabolism of alcohol, I didn't understand hollow legs and tolerance and so forth and so on. Anyway, back to finish Vietnam and went back to the States, and now I wanted to be a urologist, so I started my urology residency. Now, some of you may have heard that surgeons are, you know, have big egos. That's not true. Those of you who laughed, okay. However, I will tell you that urologists are the most skilled of all surgeons. Okay. And Dick McKinley sitting over here, Dick M., I'm sorry, is sitting over here, and he'll tell you that. He's a former urologist. Well, I was having this discussion at lunch one day with a couple surgeons. One was a neurosurgeon, and one was a general surgeon. And we got into this argument, who was the most skilled? And so I was telling them. But, and the neurosurgeon started, wait a minute. He says, I operate in the brain, delicate structures, big magnifying glasses, a slip of the scalpel. Wow, we got a stroke in my, about that time a fly flew over. He picked up his knife and went, phew, two pieces right down on his plate. General surgeon goes on to talk about how he has to operate in the whole body, everything from headaches to hemorrhoids, and the fly goes over, phew, four pieces right on his plate. Didn't faze me at all, okay? I extolling my virtues, and about that time, fly went over, and I picked up my knife, and phew, the fly kept right on going. I said, see, that just goes to show you who's the most skilled surgeon. They said, well, wait a minute. The fly is still flying. I said, flying, yes. Reproducing, no. Well, anyway, so now I'm back in my urology residency, and who's the best chief resident? You know, a lot of us have plaques on our wall, this award and that award. The one I cherished the most was the one I got from the medical students as the best teaching chief resident. And so I would delegate all my duties, and I'd get ready to go home on Saturday after I had delegated everything, and I'd report to the chief and take credit for everything that happened. And I would stop on the way home to this bar, and I'd have God knows how many beers. And I'd walk in, and my wife would be there, and she'd say, my God, you look like hell. And I said, honey, you will not believe. Okay, the week I've been through, and she said, would you like a cold beer? And I'd look at my watch, and I said, well, yeah, I suppose I could have one now. And this went on and on and on, except one Saturday I walked in, and she didn't offer me the cold beer. So I got it myself. I sat down at the kitchen table. She was over at the sink. And you know, guys, how sometimes when you walk in, you get home and the atmosphere is not quite right. It's a little chilly in there. And so when she's not saying zip, and I finally said, big mouth, asked the question, what's wrong? Nothing. Now, I should have just got up and left. No, but I had to inquire some more. What do you mean, nothing? Nothing. And I said, are you going to tell me? No, I'm not going to tell you. Why not? Because they said I couldn't tell you. And I said, who is they? Well, I'm not going to tell you that. So I said, well, pray tell, you know, you should at least tell me that. All right, I'm going to tell you this much, and that's all. Who is they? She said, Al-Anon. And I'd never heard the word. I didn't know what it was. Okay, I said, pray tell, what is Al-Anon? And she proceeded, she says, that's the place you go, okay, when someone in your family has a drinking problem, you know, in that tone of voice. And I remember sitting at the kitchen, pardon me?
Not in that tone of voice.
Honey, how many times have I told you don't correct me in front of the group? Okay. See, she's got her black belt in that damn Al-Anon cult, all right? And that's the problem. So anyway, she says, and I'm just, so I sit down at the kitchen table. I'm thinking, my God, who's got the problem in her family? Her dad doesn't drink that much. Her mother doesn't drink that much. She's got a crazy cousin, right, Tracy? I said, but she doesn't drink that much. And I'm thinking, oh, my God. And so I said, well, I'll show her. I got up, poured my beer down the sink, and I went, and I fell up the stairs. Well, anyway, long story short, we had a bunch of tragedies in the family. Lost a child, lost my favorite uncle, alcoholic, lost my dad, who was alcoholic. Anyway, go home to my hometown, do a geographic cure to practice urology, and who's being groomed to be the youngest chief of staff of the whole hospital? Me. Who's on a bank board? Me. You know, falling uphill. Doing great, picture in the paper all the time, drinking up a storm. And one night, about 7 o'clock, phone rings, general surgeon, says, come on up to the hospital. I'm on call. I've had a couple of drinks, just two. And says, I had a gunshot wound. There's blood in the kid's urine, probably hit the kidney. Come on up and help me do the surgery. Be right up. And I went to go upstairs and brush my teeth, fell up the stairs. And So, I had to call my partner. Thank God he was there. Well, this went on and on and on. Had this kid, I took out a Wilms tumor on. That's a bad kidney cancer that kids get. And in those days, there was no oncologist in Aurora, Illinois, so I was doing my own chemotherapy. And so here comes the last day of 5 days in a row, every 3 months for 2 years. Kids all excited. I got a special gift for him in the trunk of my car. I bought him a bike or a wagon. I can't remember which. Now, he was trained not to move that arm when I put that IV in there, when we'd practice and so forth and so on. But he was so excited that day. I'm just about finished injecting the 5-FU or whatever it was. I think it was actinomycin D. And nurse pulled the curtain open, and he moved his arm, and I didn't move fast enough because I had come in the hospital that morning, and I noticed I had some shakes, which I attributed, of course, to hypoglycemia. Okay. Went into the doctor's lounge when no one was looking, grabbed a handful of sugar and ate it, you know, to go in. And, of course, he got a little chemical burn, probably about that size. Could have been his whole arm. I thought it was his whole arm. It was the most terrible thing ever happened to me. I don't even like to think about it. So, he's got tears coming out of his eyes. He's not complaining or anything. We get him all bandaged up. Everything's fine. Go out and give him the bike. And he says, thank you for saving my life. And I felt so, I almost drove that Cadillac right smack into the Fox River. Okay. Now, prior to this, I'd been in the doctor's lounge. How am I doing my time, Mike?
Okay. You've got as much time as you want.
Oh, did you hear what he said? So prior to that, I was in the doctor's lounge one morning, and I'm reading the bulletin board, and here's this thing about impaired physicians. And I said to the doctor next to me, I said, what the hell is an impaired physician? He says, I don't know what one is. It's probably somebody's on drugs or mentally ill or something. I said, Who put this stupid lecture on? You know, I was going to find out who that was. We're supposed to be doing scientific things here and blah, blah, blah. So I vowed I was not going to that particular lecture. And, of course, now here's a series of coincidences, so-called coincidences, God's way of staying anonymous. Well, about 4 a.m. one morning, I got this call, and one of my patients had kidney stones going sour, got septic, so I had to go in and do the ureteral lithotomy, did the surgery, and went down. And we had breakfast meetings in this hospital. I'm going through the line, and the cafeteria is here, and there's the meeting room over there. And I'm listening as I'm going through the line. Everybody's in there. I'm the last guy. And I hear it's a stupid, impaired physician things. You know, by the way, why is it, I always wonder, why is it that only doctors are impaired? Okay, everybody else is a drunk, but physicians are impaired. Did you ever hear of an impaired plumber? You know, unless that be a urologist, a people plumber like myself. Anyway, this was Jim W., a physician from Chicago, surgeon, who was with the Illinois State Medical Society Physicians Health Program, whatever the hell that was. So I sit way in the back row. I'm not paying much attention to this guy. I don't know what possessed me. I don't remember what he said. I haven't got a clue. I went up in front of all of my colleagues and got his literature and his card. Coincidence number two. Now, why did I do that? I have no idea. Took it home, put it in my nightstand. 2 years later, okay, when I hit the bottom injecting this kid, all right, I go in... get the card. I call him up. Dr. West, yeah, hi. I told him who I was. I was from Aurora. And I said, listen, I've got this doctor friend I think's got a drinking problem. And he said, why don't you come on into Chicago tomorrow? We'll have lunch at my country club, and we'll talk about your doctor friend. I said, that's great. Okay. Speaking of this friend thing, one morning, my partner and I were up in the doctor's lounge putting our scrubs on, getting ready to do surgery, and this other doctor, third doctor, walks in. He grabs my partner, who was a senior guy in town, takes him over in the corner and whispers him, but it was a small room and I could hear him. And the third doctor's telling my partner, he says, listen, I've got this friend, okay, who's got this sore on his penis. What do you think it might be? And my partner, Ed, says, well, did your friend describe the sore? He says, well, yeah, he said it was. And Ed's asking him all these questions. You know, well, is the sore raised? Is it on the shaft? Is it on the end? Any swelling in the groin and everything? And, well, I didn't ask my friend that and everything. And finally, Ed looked over into him and says, listen, George, why don't you take your friend out and let me take a look at him? And then we'll see what the problem was. Well, anyway, that's a true story. So anyway, finally, he takes me, this doctor, I go into Chicago, takes me to my first AA meeting, huge meeting that night. Hot May night, I'm shaking, I'm sweating, the walls are sweating. I want to get out of there. Hardest words I ever had to say in my entire life was, I'm an alcoholic. Hardest words I ever had to say. You know, I was just filled with so much shame and guilt. You know, I heard it was a disease. I really didn't understand that. I thought it was a moral failing. You know, I should know better. Of all people, doctors should know better. And if it was a disease, you shouldn't have gotten it in the first place. You know what MD stands for. It's called malignant denial. And anyway, meeting's over. Every time I'm looking up, there's a guy about where Chris is. Chris, raise your hand there. Chris is from my home group. About where Chris is. Every time I look up, he's looking at me. I don't want to look at anybody. Meeting's over. I make a beeline for the door. This guy cuts me off at the pass and says, Lynn, what the hell took you so long? Okay, it was the guy I drank with at Notre Dame. I just didn't recognize him. Anyway, about that time, I decided to switch careers and get into addiction medicine, and we moved to Florida. And first, we went to Lakeland. By this time, my wife did have her black belt in Al-Anon, okay? And we got into a discussion one night in the kitchen, and it was about the kids or whatever. And she finally looked at me and said, that god-awful Al-Anon mantra. She says, you know what, honey? You may be right. And she left the room. And I didn't have anybody to argue with, okay? And, man, I was angry. I almost relapsed that night, and I realized I needed a meeting, and it was not my meeting night of the week, so I grabbed her car, and I went to this meeting, got to the meeting, there was no meeting. Okay, I went to the wrong church. And I'm sitting in this church parking lot. Here's the light, street light coming in, and about where that speaker is, across the street, there's a bar with my beer, Miller High Life, a sign blinking on and off in the window. And I almost went over there and drank and almost relapsed that night. But sitting on her seat was one of those Al-Anon books, Courage or Change or something. And I picked that up, and that saved my bananas that night. I'm very grateful to Al-Anon for many, many reasons. I joke a lot about it. I'll pay for it later. Anyway, so then I was doing just great. I was medical director of this addiction treatment program and so forth and so on. But you know what? I didn't have a sponsor there. And I thought I'd worked the steps. And I read the first 164 pages. Why would I need to read it again? I'm a doctor, okay? And blah, blah, blah. And so I was on the Surrendus Dry Drunk. And I went to IDAA, International Doctors in AA, in Minneapolis, 1983. And Dr. Paul, from page 417 of the big book, Acceptance, gave the spirituality talk. And he said, there's two kinds of people in this world, drinkers and non-drinkers. And he said, the drinkers, there's two kinds. There's alcoholics and non-alcoholics. And the alcoholics, there's two kinds. There's the practicing ones and the recovering ones. And what makes a difference is the recovering ones have done step 4 and 5, right? Boom, bingo, lightning, shoo. So I did step 4 and 5, and I got a sponsor, and I got working the steps and so forth. And finally, I got some self-esteem back. You know, I developed a relationship with God. I was able to look in the mirror one more time. So now we moved to Miami, another treatment center, and everything's fine there. Even my kids are going to ACOA in college, and Alateen for the boys. And Julie, she was 8 years old. In Miami, they had Alitot. So in Julie's school, they had Citizen of the Week. You walk in on Monday, yeah, and you get a star. You don't mess up the next 4 days. You get 4-5 stars in a row. Citizen of the Week, ice cream with the principal, big deal. Julie'd get 4, and she'd blow it. She'd get 4, and she'd blow it. She'd get 4, and she'd blow it. And I'm thinking, apple doesn't fall far from the tree. I get 8 first Fridays. I'd never get the 9th one, you know. 8, never get the 9th one. So pick her up one day. She comes out all excited. I did it. I did it. So we go have ice cream. I said, well, Julie, how'd you do it? Oh, she said, Dad, it was easy. I said, whoa, wait a minute. Easy? You've been struggling with this all year. She says, well, I finally learned how to do it. I said, well, where'd you learn that? She says, Dad, you know, in parentheses, you dummy. Dad, I learned in my meetings. I said, really? How's that? She said, Dad, you just do it one day at a time. She's 8 years old. Okay, I'm 50, and I haven't learned a lesson yet. Well, after Miami, I decided to move to Seattle and do the physician's health program. It was time to do payback, and it was really great. And it's not exactly easy work when you have physicians as patients. That malignant denial kicks in, and all the PHP buddies are out there shaking their head. But it's a wonderful work, and I was very, very, very grateful to have been able to do that. So you've heard what it was like and what happened. So what it's like now? Well, there's a guy in my Sun Valley group who always talks about this program has given me stuff beyond my wildest dreams. And the first time I heard that, and I thought, oh my God, that is Bill Wilson hype. That is it. Bill at his marketing best. Actually, his marketing best was when I used to hear the promises. Are these extravagant promises? Everybody said, no. And I'd say, hell yes, they are. I mean, this is ridiculous, these stupid promises. I got to tell you, the promises have all come true for me. I mean, every blasted one of them. Well, self-seeking hasn't quite slipped away. But I'm working on that, okay? Why is my home group nodding like that? Okay. I'm really working on that. And I've learned some things. First of all, I've learned that the name of this disease is alcoholism, not alcoholism. It doesn't go away. And that I have to be vigilant. This is important. Resentment is not my number one offender. Okay? I don't have any resentments. And if I get one, I should be able to handle them by now. Complacency is my number one offender. I can let my guard down. Unfortunately, in the past couple years, 3 or 4 people with 20-plus years that I personally know have gone back out. And you know what? When people with 20-plus years go back out, they don't make it back in, as a general rule. I don't want to be one of those. I still got to do this every day. I've learned that sobriety is a gift, and it was certainly a gift for me, nothing I did. But recovery is my job. Recovery is my job. I got to do the work. I've also learned that recovery requires maintenance. I still have work to do. All of my character defects, God has not taken them away. Judgmentalism, that's my number one. Okay? It's terrible. Okay? Humility is not my strong suit. Some of you may have picked that up already. Okay? I like the definition of humility that's in the 12 and 12 in the chat and the step 5 discussion, not in step 7, where it says humility is a clear understanding of who and what you really are, followed by a sincere attempt to be all you can be. I like that. That definition works for me. Speaking of being all you can be, I have to tell you about my grandson, Jamie, age 8. Jamie's playing soccer, and he comes off the field. And he's looking around for his water bottle, and we realize he's left it in the car. And I, Grandpa, I'm thirsty. I said, well, here, you can have some of my drink. And he drinks it. And he says, Grandpa, what's this? I says, it's Diet Coke. Whoa. He says, this is really good. Well, I realized he'd never had it. Now, unfortunately, okay, he went home and told his mother, okay, my daughter, Mrs. Organic, all right, who read me the riot act, explaining that I had permanently altered 4 million of his brain cells, that his intestinal flora was so upset he would get AIDS probably by tomorrow morning, and blah, 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 blah. Next day, we're at the soccer watching his brother. It's halftime. Jamie says to me, Grandpa, I'm thirsty. I said, well, let's go get some. He says, can I have a Diet Coke? I said, no way, Jamie. He says, why not? I said, because you have a big mouth. That's why. Which was probably hereditary. All right. And he turns around and he's pouting. And about 30 seconds go by and he turns around and looks at me with these big brown eyes and he says, Grandpa, why don't you just be the grandpa I know you could be? And I thought, my God. He's got too much of my DNA already. Anyway, the other thing I've learned more recently, you know, the longer you go in this program for me with all my grandiosity and lack of humility and everything else, is I get to think I need all the answers. And of course, people in your home group, tend to guruize you. And as you get more time and, they come to you for answers. I have found out I no longer come to AA to get my questions answered. I come to AA to get my answers questioned because I don't have them all. And the last thing I've learned is that if you go to meetings, you feel better. But if you work the steps, all right, you get better. And I got to keep the steps simple. 1, 2, and 3, that's for me, that's giving up. And 4 through 7 is cleaning up. And 8 and 9 are making up. And 10, 11, and 12 are growing up. And here we are, back to growing up. So let me close by asking you a question. I'm a doctor, and I like to prescribe medicine, as most of you who are doctors in this room do. So if I told you I had a medicine that would change your whole life for the better, would you take it? If I told you this medicine would put you in a relaxed state of serenity, it would help you overcome the nagging undercurrent of guilt for your past errors, would you take it? What if I went on to say that it would give you new insight into yourself and your spiritual values and let you cope with life's challenges with confidence and courage? Would you take it? Now, if I told you this medicine has been thoroughly tested and found to be very effective, has no side effects, and there's not a single recorded case of an allergic reaction to this medicine, and furthermore, it does not require a prescription and it's free, would you take it? Well, that medicine exists. It's not a new discovery. In fact, it's been around for 80 years. It's called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks for letting me share.